Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, October 8th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. And as always, I want to thank those of you who have supported the show within the last week. But before I do so, I want to tell you that there's a brand new way to support the show, and this one is really cool. On top of visiting patreon.com/talknerdy, which I highly recommend, it is massively helpful, you can also now go to talknerdymerch.com, or you can click through on my website, karasantamaria.com. But oh my gosh, that's so many URLs. How are you going to keep them straight? Let me say it again. Talknerdymerch.com. I finally updated my store. It has lots of cool t-shirts and tank tops and hoodies and mugs and onesies for your baby and other things, socks. So many choices. So take a look, visit, see if there's anything you might like. It's a great way to support the show because all the proceeds go right into making Talk Nerdy possible. But of course, like I mentioned, you can always go to patreon.com and pledge your support. As little as 50 cents per episode, it goes an awful long way. This week, I want to thank my tippy top supporter, Rob Schreck, along with Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Phil T-Bear, The Zombie Drummer, David J.E. Smith, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jafe, Gabriel, Felipe, Romeo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell, along with all the rest of you who support the show each week. Okay, what have we got this week? Ooh, it's a good one. I had the chance to talk to Ryan North. Now, you probably know Ryan because he is the writer of Dinosaur Comics. He's also written Machine of Death and Unbeatable Squirrel Girl for Marvel. He has written these cool choose-your-own-path books that involve Shakespearean heroes, which is amazing. And he's super, super funny. But today we're going to be talking about his brand newest book. It's called How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler. So guys, without any further ado, here he is, Ryan North. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited because oftentimes I'll have authors on the show promoting a new book, and we talk about the book the whole time, and we're going to do that because this book is hilarious and fascinating and all that good stuff. But you have such an interesting career that I'm excited to talk about all the cool stuff that you do for a living.
Oh, great. I know all the answers when we talk about me, so I feel confident.
Good, because that's what we're going to do this whole time. I promise I won't talk about me once. Yeah, right. My listeners know that's impossible. So we're going to talk about your new book in a minute. It's called How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler. But before we dive into that, I want to talk about some of the cool stuff that you've done. I mean, would you call yourself a multi-purpose writer? Like, what would you say is your sort of umbrella job? I mean, obviously, you're like a freelancer, like many a people. But like, what would you say you do for a living?
I've always been twitchy around labels. So I normally would just say writer. I liked what you said. What do you just describe me as just now?
You're a multi-purpose writer.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. Like a Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, because you write comics too, which I think a lot of people don't think of when they think of writing.
Oh yeah, no, comics is where I started. It's still my favorite medium. I think it's such a great way to do anything because you have words and pictures working together, and especially for explaining things, pictures can help you where the words fall down and vice versa. Which makes me sound like I should have written this book as a comic, but I didn't because there are a lot of words. But yeah, I do comics, I do all sorts of stuff.
When you do your comics, do you draw them too, or you just write them?
Oh, just writing. That's the easy job. It takes me, 10 seconds to write on this page, Finn and Jake fight 1,000 ninjas, and they'll take all day to draw. So writers always have the easy job in comics.
When you're writing comics, obviously my assumption, and maybe my assumption is wrong, is that the process is very personal. So it's different for different people. But when you are partnered with your designer, your illustrator, do you plan it all first? Do they draw it first and then you write it? Do you write it first and then they draw it?
Oh, wow.
How does that work?
So normally the way it's done is I write it first and then they draw it. But I did a project years ago now called Whispered Apologies. It's no longer online, but that was where the artist would draw blank comics, like comics without any word balloons or blank word balloons, and I would write those in. But yeah, normally the process is for a new project, ideally, you talk to the artist and you get to know each other and hopefully become friends. And you ask them, what do you like to draw and what do you hate to draw? Because if you hate drawing cars, I don't need to put in a freeway scene. They can just have a conversation at a coffee shop and we can avoid it. And if you like to draw something, let's go for that and I'll put it in. I mean, I'm very aware that as the artist, as a writer rather, what I'm writing, they're going to be drawing for a month. Like a comic writer can write maybe an issue a week. So 4 issues a month. A comic artist can do 1 issue a month. That's the only thing they're doing. And they're going to spend a lot more time in the universe of the story than you are. Because if you say this conversation, you know, they're in a coffee shop and they're having a conversation about something. That's about as far as I've thought of it. The artist will think, okay, so what time of day is it? What are they wearing? What kind of coffee shop is it? Is it a fancy shop? Do they have the money to go to a fancy shop? All these thoughts you have to think to actually draw the scene. Well, for me, again, with the easy job writing, I just say they're at a coffee shop having coffee.
So script writers oftentimes for television or film, you know, the script is not just the dialogue. It's everything in the world. They describe every scene. They describe the look on the characters' faces. You don't do that when you write for comics. You leave all of that kind of creative stuff up to the artist.
Not all of it. Like, I mean, reading a screenplay, I find it very thin. So I'm like, oh, they're at a coffee shop and they're having this and they're having a conversation. But in comics, I'll say, you know, they're at a coffee shop and panel one, this person says this and the other person reacts with surprise. Panel two, the second person takes a sip of their coffee as they're thinking. Panel three, the person now speaks. Like I'm working out the beats of the conversation, the beats of the story. But even that, it's more than a screenplay, but it's less than what the artist actually needs to draw the scene. There's always, they're bringing their own thing to it and they're adding a lot to it to make it fully realized.
What a fun job to be able to be so collaborative with somebody else where you're both bringing something incredibly unique, something that the other person really couldn't do on their own together. And it becomes something, you know, kind of a gestalt, as it were, something kind of greater than it would be on its own.
Yeah, no, it's what I love about it, because like I do the writing and then the artist does the drawing and there's usually a colorist who colors it. And that adds a whole layer of emotion to the scene. And there's inkers and letters, everything else. So it's a very collaborative medium. And the best part about it, at least for a writer, is that people tend to give you a lot more credit than you deserve. So they read a good comic and they say, Ryan wrote a really good comic there. And they won't realize that, you know, the artist might have seen my script and said, you know what? You have this in 5 panels. I'm going to break it into 6 to have that beat land a little better. And I'll move this panel to the next page. The neat thing about comics from any other form of writing is that the basic unit is the page. So comics are very hard to edit once you've written them because you can't just remove 3 panels and shift them around like you can a paragraph in prose, because that changes the whole layout of the page. So it's, you're always thinking of, what does this page look like? What's the message that this page conveys? Well, in prose, you're just writing in paragraphs and you stop when you're done, right?
And of course, you're using that word page over and over because, you know, you created Dinosaur Comics, you wrote for Adventure Time, Jughead, the Unbeatable Squirrel Girl for Marvel. But you also mentioned earlier a webcomic that you worked on, and that must be a really different endeavor than a printed comic.
Yeah, Dinosaur Comics it's like a gag a day comic.
Yeah.
And the thing with Dinosaur Comics is, it's just still the basic unit is a page, but basic unit is the 6 panels, because Dinosaur Comics has the same 6 panels every time with just the words changed. And when I describe it, I always say it's better than it sounds, because that sounds horrible. But I've been doing it for like 15 years. And it's a trick I found when I was starting out wanting to write comics and not knowing how to draw, not being able to draw, was, well, what if we had a comic where it was the same pictures in different words, and then you'd only have to draw it once? I didn't even draw it. It's clip art. Like, it's a very visually lazy comic. But I learned so much doing it.
It's difficult what you're doing. I mean, like, you know, we talk about creativity a lot in my field. I'm working in psychology now. And mm-hmm. you know, how do you define creativity? What is creativity? How do we research creativity? And one of the things that I always come back to is this idea that it can't just be open-ended. There have to be constraints. Mm-hmm. Like, it's mm-hmm. much more difficult to be creative when you have constraint. And God, you must run out of ideas.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it is such a constraint on one hand, because it's the same 6 panels of a green dinosaur and a brown dinosaur. And it looks like they're having a conversation and that's it. But, you know, I'm never facing a blank sheet of paper. I always know about how long the comic's going to be. It's going to be 6 panels. I know the personality of the characters I kind of get for free because they're drawn in a certain way. T-Rex looks excited, so he's going to be an excitable guy. And I feel like, I always think about this, like I've been doing Dinosaur Comics for 15 years. with the same pictures. Jesus. And doing what I know, but doing one a day, that's an achievable thing to do. Like that's 3 hours a day to write a comic and you're done. But I always imagine like if I hadn't put those comics online and instead I just stayed at home and like wallpapered the walls with them, you'd walk into this room with 15 years of comics with the same pictures by surprise and think, this is the house of a crazy person. No one sane would do this. This is like madness made manifest. But by putting it online slowly, it's a nice comic you can read for a joke in the morning. It becomes much more reasonable.
But you say over and over that, you know, doing it one a day is really manageable, you know, just 3 hours a day. No, that's not the only thing you do for a living. You write books, you know, you write other comics. So there must be times when you batch write these things. There's no way you could sit down and dedicate 3 full hours of every day of your life to this.
So I will tell you, for the first, gosh, probably 12 years, I wrote one a day.
No.
And the worst thing was, I would write it the morning it went up. So I'd try to get up at 7, have the comic up, or at 6, have the comic up for 9. And that was a horrible way to do it.
For 12 years?
Yeah, it was awful because if I, you know, had a slow start that morning, the comic would be delayed. So that was for the first like 5 years. And then I got smart and wrote one extra comic one day. So I had a backlog of one and then the comic could always go up on time. And then it was only about 12 years where I thought, you know what? I think I'm ready. I'm going to try to write 2 comics a day, right? 3 comics a day. So I can get the stuff done. Nowadays, Monday is for dinosaur comics. And I get it all written. And then I have Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday for other stuff.
Good for you. That seems like the only way I could handle doing it. Let me see. So it's September 7th right now that we're recording. Mm-hmm. And our episode is going to go up. I'm looking at my spreadsheet right now. I'm definitely a spreadsheet girl. Our episode is going to go up on October 8th in a month. That is how I roll. It's the only way I could do it. And that's actually, you know, a month of backlog. You know, we do this, or I do this show once a week. So that's only 4 episodes of backlog. So I guess it's about the same. But I think I would be in full on panic mode if I didn't have a backlog. Because otherwise, how do you, you know, take a weekend? How do you, what happens when you get sick?
I tell you, one time I had hernia surgery on my belly. I had a belly button hernia, and it was day surgery, which I didn't bother researching that phrase. I thought it meant you go in, they do it, and you're done. It takes a day, like no problem. I didn't factor in it would take me like 3 weeks to recover, and I'd be on these really powerful painkillers for the first couple days. So I was trying to write comics while under the influence of these painkillers. And I had the vague sense that these weren't good comics. They seemed really great when I wrote them. So I just put up a note being like, yeah, I'm on a lot of painkillers right now. So sorry if these comics are more inscrutable than normal. And that's where it caught me, right? That, I mean, I was also on painkillers while I read the reception. And I feel like they like them. I haven't gone back to check, really. Trying to put that time in the past, the part of my life in the past.
I love that. That's so funny. But I also love that you know, you're able to use your creativity and your skills through these different outlets. I think that's what really makes kind of life worth living as a creator, is not doing the exact same thing every day. You have your webcomic that is a real challenge, and it's your kind of long-standing thing that at this point, I'm sure you have like self-imposed rules about, or self-imposed deadlines and things like that. But you also write books, and both comic books and actual books. You've written 2 choose your own adventure type books, haven't you?
Choosable path adventure. Because okay, choose your own adventure is a trademark phrase.
I see.
One is a trademark phrase that I am similar but legally distinct from.
Do they still make them?
I think so. They had a Kickstarter a couple years ago that they didn't end up going with, but they have plans for them at least. I think they're republishing the old ones.
I have to say, I mean, that was huge when I was a kid. Like, we loved Choose Your Own Adventure, TM. They were so much fun. So is that what inspired you to write like your sort of version of that?
Well, I mean, I always liked the books and I liked the sort of crazy adventures you could go on. But the inspiration was, and I'll preface this story by saying it makes me sound smarter than I am. But what happened was I was driving back from visiting my parents, listening to the radio, and they had this actor on. And the actor was saying, you know, back in my day, when you auditioned, you would just read, or rather perform, a monologue you had memorized. And nowadays, no one has any monologues memorized. They just read whatever they're supposed to read for the bit. And I was trying to think, do I have any monologues memorized? Like, do I have poetry in my brain? And the best I came up with was Hamlet's to be or not to be soliloquy. And I was turning that over my head and I was like, Hamlet, you know, to be or not to be, that is a question. And I was like, wow, it's structured like a choice. Like in those choose your own adventure books I used to read. And then I was like, oh my God, you could make this into a book. Like you'd have Hamlet play as Hamlet to go through the play and make these choices. And the book kind of fully formed on that car ride. Like instead of a play within a play, you'd have a book within a book, and you could choose your characters and you play as a feeler, or you play as Hamlet's dad. If you choose him, you die in the first page and play as a ghost for the rest of the game or book. So it was a lot of fun.
Oh, that's so cool.
Thank you.
I love that. That's like, it speaks to my inner child, but as a grown up, which makes me so happy. And I'm seeing here that you actually, the book that, you know, the publicist reached out to me about, the book that really inspired us to get together and have a conversation today, How to Invent Everything, was a Kickstarter.
Yeah, it was sort of a weird Kickstarter. So the book was written when we did the...
So much money. Sorry to interrupt you. Like, I just scrolled down. Whoa. Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks. It was a sort of new way of using Kickstarter that I hope it catches on. So basically, we had the book done, and we used the Kickstarter like a pre-order campaign to encourage people to get the book, and we took the sales from the Kickstarter and sent those through indie bookstores. So the idea of it was, rather than people buying the book on Amazon, which they're not hurting for money, if we do this Kickstarter thing, you can buy it online, and it'll feel Amazon-esque, but it'll go through indie bookstores, and we'll be able to use some of those funds to do added things like, you know, postcards from different time periods and a time travel survival bandana and stuff like that. So it was an experiment that worked, which I was glad, because Kickstarters are a lot of work to do.
Are they? Does it really take a lot of time?
Oh, God, it's like a full-time job for a month.
Ugh.
It's so much work. There's so much work. They're fun, but they're a lot of work.
Oh, my gosh. These postcards are amazing.
Thank you.
Are these like prints? Are they prints?
They're postcards. The backs tips for surviving in the different time periods.
Oh, they're so beautiful. Okay, so let's talk about this because we're kind of talking around it instead of talking about it. How to Invent Everything is, as the subtitle says explicitly, a survival guide for the stranded time traveler. Mm-hmm. So this is a big endeavor to write about basically all of history and how to build a civilization from scratch. First of all, What motivated you to take on this, I would say this project, you know, that's a big thing to bite off and say, I want to write this book. So A, what motivated you to do that? And how long did it take you?
Gosh. So, I mean, you probably hear from writers before where they write the books they want to read. Mm-hmm. That feels pretty common to me. And I'd always wanted to read a book about this subject matter. The idea of if you were sent back in time, what could you do? What could you change? And I've thought of this since I, you know, saw Back to the Future at age 6. And I kept thinking this sort of fantasy/nightmare of, you know, being sent back in time 100 years and saying, guys, the future is great. We have computers and they're awesome. And people saying, great, how do you build one? And me saying, I don't know. But trust me. Like, I didn't feel competent enough to explain civilization. And so I kept wanting to have a book that would explain that for me. And finally, like, well, I guess I'll write it. I did a t-shirt of it first, just like a t-shirt that had a cheat sheet for civilization. It's like, here's how you make penicillin real quick. And here's the basics of flight. And here's where you can find aluminum, which will make you tons of money if you're in the right time period. And here's how you extract it. And
so is the bandana on the Kickstarter sort of taken from that?
Yeah, so it's the shirt came first, and I think this is the world's first book based off a t-shirt.
I love that.
And then the bandana was a sort of a revised version of the shirt for the Kickstarter, make it a bit more practical, because the bandana can also be used to like filter water or make a sling. Yes.
And so was all this stuff on the t-shirt, or was the t-shirt not quite this detailed? Because this is very detailed.
The bandana is more detailed, yeah. Bandana has, I think, about twice the information the t-shirt had, and the book has, you know, orders of magnitude more.
And it's not just words, right? Like, it does have a lot of information in the form of words, but it's also got a ruler, and it's also got some math things that I don't understand. Oh, a compass. No, is that a compass? I don't know what that is.
Protractor. Yeah.
A protractor, yes. And then it's got gears and little kind of schematics for things.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a bunch of pictures in the book, too.
It's mainly like the golden record, kind of.
Yeah. The golden record is crazy. Sorry, this is an aside, but... Yeah. My favorite bit of the Golden Record, and I guess for your listeners who don't know what we're talking about, it's a record that was put on the Voyager spacecraft, which is one of the first spacecraft to leave our solar system.
Yeah, so Sagan had a lot to do with what ended up on it, and yeah, it's awesome and amazing, but also kind of weird, and probably will never have an impact, but maybe it will. Who knows?
Maybe. But the best thing, they have these digitalized pictures of like, here's what humans look like and here's what they do. My favorite one, it's a picture that's ostensibly, here's how humans consume food. But the actual picture is just like three like 70s looking people. And one is pouring water into his mouth from like way up high. Water pouring in. The other guy's licking an ice cream cone. Like, it's like this weird 70s food fetish party that's just stuck on this spacecraft that's now out of our solar system. And is, I believe, the fastest human-made object right now is the Voyager spacecraft.
Yeah.
But it's worth looking up. It's crazy.
It's left the heliopause now. It's like out there. You know, at this point,
gone. I mean,
nothing on it works anymore. But the point of the golden record is that it actually has schematics for how to like build a record player and be able to read it. So, you know.
I think it's still, there's still something that works. There's still some power. Not enough to power in the instruments, but I think the power actually finishes in around 2032. It's close to being completely dead.
Yeah.
But it's not yet completely all the way dead.
But the good news about space is that even if something is completely dead, it's still flying around.
Yeah, it's still going to keep moving at ridiculous speeds and hopefully hopefully not smash into an alien planet and make them mad at us. Because we put a map to ourselves on Voyager.
This is how you find us. This is how you find us.
You want more of our nudes. There's some over here.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, in a way, your bandana is a slightly more modern golden record, but it's not for an alien civilization. It's for us, right? Or is it? Who is the intended user?
So the intended user, the whole premise of the book is that in the future, time travel is routine and done for tourism purposes. And like any sort of rented machine, sometimes it breaks down. And so if your time machine does break down, then this is the repair guide in the time machine that says, here's how you fix it. And it very quickly says, look, there's no user serviceable parts inside of this machine. You are trapped where you are. But since we can't tell you how to fix a time machine, we'll tell you how to rebuild civilization from scratch. You can bring the future back to you. So here's how you do that instead.
Gotcha. So this really applies in case if you go back in time. It's not that helpful if you're going forward in time.
No, it's all for going back in time. But the premise is that it's designed for someone without any specialized knowledge to do everything in the book. And it also doesn't make any assumptions about what time period you're in. So for those of us who aren't yet trapped in the past, it makes you feel like a more competent. It made me feel, at least writing it, like a more competent person. Like I now understand, you know, how a kiln works. And I feel like I can make electricity if I need to. Stuff like that, that before was not, I wouldn't say it was magic, but it felt like black boxy. Like, I don't know how this works, but it works. It's fine. I'll never need to worry about this. But now I'm like, I know how it works. And if I needed to, I could probably make it again.
This is so genius, because not only is it like incredibly empowering, it sort of hides the science in the narrative.
Yeah, well, that's
so important.
Sorry, go on.
No.
Please continue the compliments.
yes, I shall. No, I mean, this is something that's so meaningful for science communication, which is, of course, what this show is about. It's what I do. It's what a lot of my colleagues do. A lot of the people I talk to on the show do for a living. And it's such an important way in. Like, how do I tell this story, which is basically packing a bunch of information in a really dense way, but making it very user-friendly and having kind of a shtick to it. And I think that this is such a brilliant way to bring this information to really readers of like all ages.
Thank you. It was something that I guess is going to sound like I'm giving myself a compliment. I don't mean it that way, but I was surprised at how well it worked because it meant that with this, the book's basically a nonfiction core with like a fictional candy coating of the time travel element of it. And with that, it meant that, you know, whenever something in the science I'm trying to convey got too heavy or too dense or too boring, you could put a joke in there built around the whole ridiculous premise of the book. And it made it feel so much breezier and accessible. And also, it gave it kind of like a ticking clock, right? Like the premise, the idea that you've landed in the past and your time machine's broken and you're just flipping through this book trying to figure out how to fix things before something goes wrong felt like it had a forward momentum and an inertia that you don't normally get to have when you're writing nonfiction.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I don't know how much writers enjoy being compared to other writers. It's probably super annoying. So I apologize in advance if
I love it.
Oh, okay. It's very
usually better than me. And I'm like, this is great.
It's very Andy Weir. You know, it's a very smart name.
Thank you.
And I mean, I think that that was really a big celebration for a lot of people who read The Martian, at least, that it was this very technical, very information dense story that was so like bitingly funny
engaging,
it was okay. And once things kind of got too overwhelming, you always bring in the humor right at the right time. And that's the important part there.
Did you see the movie version of The Martian?
I did see the movie version. Let's have a conversation about that real quick.
Okay, brief aside, because my wife hadn't read the book, and I went to see the movie with her, and I was stunned watching the movie because I felt like it was a version of the book where all his problems were easier. It was like he's doing this Martian adventure on easy mode, and it made me really appreciate how the book like did not relent, and everything that could go wrong did go wrong until he's just at the edge of failure, and then by being clever, pulls it out and makes it success.
Oh, yeah. And I wouldn't even say at the edge of failure. Like, he straight up fails multiple times. And it's like, I'm going to die. But then he kind of figures it out. You're right.
Edge of ultimate failure, then. Edge of death. He doesn't die.
He almost dies. No, it's true. And I do think the film was quite good. I don't want to like dump all over the film because I think they did a good job given the parameters and the constraints of film. They only had 2 hours, right? So they had to tell a briefer version within those 2 hours. But I would be really sad if I had seen the movie first, because then when I read the book, I would be thinking in terms of those constraints of the film. The book obviously had so much more depth and so much more breadth to it. So I was glad to be able to read it in that way. I also was one of those people who kind of started reading it early on before it was actually published as a book.
When
it
was published
as a serial. Yeah, I didn't start like at the very beginning, but that was a really fun kind of, I don't know. I felt like I got to be a part of it in a way, which was cool.
Did you read the original ending that was on the website that he didn't end up taking down?
Yes. And I appreciate both versions. I understand the reasoning for all of it. You know what I mean?
No, like I loved getting to see both of them. Be like, yeah, you can see the thought process that led from one to the other.
Exactly.
And it's nice to see. I think even as a writer, just as a reader, it's so interesting to see the, not even the first draft, but an earlier draft of something, and then seeing how it gets better and noticing just like the small tweaks that are done to make it so much better than what it was before. I love that sort of stuff.
Well, and also like you have this special kind of perspective too, because you've written these choose your own path. Is that what you're calling them?
Yes.
Choose your own path. Books before, which, oh my goodness, like the amount of brain power it must take to just sketch out. Did you like storyboard them? Do you have like the beautiful mind shit all over your wall at home?
And this is the thing. So that's, I've been looking for a way to describe that because I call it the insanity wall.
The
you know, pieces of paper, strings between them. And I was curious because I used software to do it. So if I was to do my actual insanity wall, it would be like 2 stories big and 5 stories wide or whatever. But I had a friend who had worked with people who had done these earlier books in the 80s. And I was like, how did you write them without computers? And they said, oh, well, you know, it's what you're thinking. We either had an insanity wall or the insanity floor, which meant there was limits on how long these books could get. Because To Be or Not to Be, the Hamlet version, the Choose Your Path Hamlet one, that was 90,000 words. And Romeo and or Juliet, the first draft was 150,000 words, which is too many words. And we cut that down to like 120 for publication.
How many pages is that?
Oh, God. The first version of To Be was 768 pages.
Wow.
A lot of white space there we cut down.
But that also means that you can read it so many times.
That's what I love about it. Like, I love the idea of a book with surprises because we feel like we know what a book is. And especially Choose Your Own Path books or Choose Your Adventure books, these are books that have typically been written for children. And when you start writing them for a more adult audience, I don't mean like they're not sexy books. A more non-juvenile audience is the word I'm looking for. Well, there is a sex scene in Romeo and Juliet and or Juliet, but it's done as a Mad Libs where you fill in the words. So you choose your own sex scene. But you can have fun with it. But this is what I'm talking about. The idea that when you start writing these for non-juvenile audience, you come up with these neat tricks. There's one I was super proud of where there's an unlockable character in Romeo and or Juliet where you start and you can play as either Romeo or Juliet, but you can also unlock a third playable character and it's invisible on the page. And I was so pleased with that trick. I'll tell you the trick because it's pretty neat.
Yes, please.
So basically when you beat the game, the book, there's little hearts that show you the path Shakespeare took through the book. The premise is that Shakespeare plagiarized his plays from mine by just reading through my book once and then writing that down. I love that I can, A, sort of write a story in which Shakespeare plagiarizes me, and B, talk about, I've done some, you know, me and Bill Shakespeare have done some work together, a couple books.
Yeah, you know, old Bill.
Yeah. But so if you follow Bill's path all the way to the end, you reach the ending where Juliet kills herself. And it's really dramatic in my version of it, because my version of Juliet is really strong. Romeo solves his problems by sweet talking, and Juliet's got the muscles, which mm-hmm. I like, because you never really see a muscly Juliet. She's
no, super you ripped. Don't.
So the narrator of the book is so impressed when you use your muscles to kill yourself in this really dramatic way. He's like, wow, I want to reward you. I'll give you this new character to play as. And to unlock her, the character is Rosalind, to unlock her, when you replay the book, it'll say, you know, choose, I almost said Mario or Luigi, choose Romeo or Juliet. If you choose Romeo, turn to page X. If you choose Juliet, turn to page Y. Instead of doing that, take X and Y, add them together, take the square root, divide by 2, add 3 or whatever, and turn to that page instead. And so by storing state information in the mind of the reader, you can hide stuff on the page in plain sight that you can't cheat to get at. You have to actually change the state of yourself to unlock this new character in the book. I thought that was so neat. Like, there's so much cool stuff you can do when you can approach this like it's a, like you're not writing for kids. You can write it for anyone. There's so much potential in this form of writing, I think, that's still yet untapped.
Absolutely. Because, I mean, you're right. Historically, the Choose Your Own Adventure books were for children. I mean, we all grew up with them. Well, we didn't all grow up with them, but many of us grew up with them and remember them fondly. But gamification is not just for children.
No.
And gamifying a book, like really having it have this like analog meets kind of modern video game mentality is so cool.
Yeah. And there's neat. It's neat because they're very different beasts. So you think, oh, it's like a video game. But in a video game, keeping track of state is cheap. And you tend to have a lot of very small decisions. Like if you're playing a first-person shooter, you're choosing where to go, who to shoot. But your endings, you're always going to reach the same end of the level. But in a book, state's very expensive. And so your choices tend to be fewer and more far between, but they're major choices, because you don't want to, if you have a choice to like sit in a chair or not sit in the chair, and no matter what you choose, the same stuff happens, only you're sitting or standing. You're like, why is this in the book? My choice meant nothing. You want your choices to be impactful. But on the flip side, you don't want them to be too impactful. Because I remember reading Choose Your Adventure books as a kid where, you know, if you sit in the chair, aliens invade. And if you stand, the earth explodes. And you're like, well, my choices should not have that size of an influence. Like that just makes like my choices things, again feel meaningless.
Those things do not compare. They have nothing to do with one another.
Yeah. So there's a sweet spot. You want your choices to be meaningful, but not too impactful, but not also not impactful enough. And a lot of, I think, writing a book like this is trying to find that sweet spot of making the choices matter. I understand why they did that, because whenever you have a choice, your decision tree splits, and very quickly you end up with a huge, unwieldy mess of a story. So you're always trying to prune the nodes, and that's either killing the player off or bringing a way to loop it back in gracefully if you can.
Yeah, because math.
We can't say this. But the advantage is, because these stories are written with these pieces of paper with lines between them, conceptually, they're very easy to edit, because you can just, like when I would cut down Romeo from 150 to 120,000 words, I just cut off nodes of that decision tree, and suddenly there were 10,000 words gone, and everything else was fine. Didn't impact the rest of the book. But cutting out 10,000 words from a novel, that's like a month's worth of work, right? Because everything's interconnected.
Well, and it's so hard too, because, I mean, it's easy because it was the kind of end of a branch, right? End of a node, as you put it. But it must be hard to kill your darlings in that way, something that you spent all this time on.
Nah, it's easy.
You learn that over time, but it can't always feel good.
My secret is I would read what I cut out, take the jokes I liked the best, and put them in the stuff I kept. So I was just sort of autopsying and taking the organs that were still useful and cramming them into the rest of the book.
You know what this also reminds me of is that movie Run Lola Run. Did you ever see that movie?
I love that movie, yeah.
Yeah, it has that vibe to it, right? If only, like that, you know, make one different decision. And those were all sort of butterfly effect, but they made sense downstream why such big changes would take place.
Yep, and it's that same time travel mechanic of going back and changing things and making them better or worse by accident that I think is such an interesting idea.
I like that you just segged back to time travel, because we should be talking about that book, but you have so much other cool stuff.
That wasn't even intentional. I'm just so smooth.
You're unintentionally good.
That's the other thing about my new book.
I'm looking on your website and I'm going to reach out to your publisher because I want this book, How to Be a T-Rex. It looks like it's for kids, but I'm a big kid.
Yeah, I'll get you to send one. I'll get them to send you one. That's right. That's a picture book I wrote about a little girl named Sal who she loves T-Rexes and she's very small. And her brother is like, you'll never be a T-Rex. You stop liking them. It's stupid. And she's like, well, I'm going to be one. And he says, well, you can't. It's impossible. She's like, well, no one's tried. I'm going to be the first to try. And then she tries and becomes a T-Rex. And she's like, this is great. I'm a giant dinosaur. All my problems are over. But of course, there are problems that come from being a giant dinosaur that are different than the problems that come from being a tiny girl. And she has fun with that. It was a fun book to write. I didn't intentionally have two books that begin with how to come out in the same year. It just happened that way. How to Be a T-Rex and How to Invent Everything. That's the gamut of the Ryan North experience.
Yes. And of course, one is more for grownups and one is more for kids, but vice versa, yep. Right? Kids can read How to Invent Everything and grownups can read the T-Rex book. I would love to be a T-Rex one day. I don't know if you know this about me, but I am obsessed with dinosaurs and they have taken over my office and I have one tattooed on my arm and I'm basically a 5-year-old trapped in a 35-year-old's body.
So this is why we're getting along so well, because I've done dinosaur comics for 15 years. I get all the dinosaur news sent to me by readers. So I started dinosaur comics. Like I thought dinosaurs were pretty cool, but I didn't really have a in-depth knowledge of them. And now I feel like I'm pretty good at dinosaurs. I like dinosaurs. And the nice part with dinosaur comics is that there's the three main characters, T-Rex, Utahraptor, and Dromaeosaurus. But Dromaeosaurus doesn't exist as a dinosaur anymore.
Yeah, that happens in paleontology.
Yeah. And so if you search for Dromaeosaurus, I'm like the top hit because no one else is using this now discredited name except for me. And I'm like, well, that's her name. She's Dromaeosaurus. I'm not going to change that. I did a comic where she has a house in another town where she goes by a different name, which is the new name for her species. I forget what it is. It's not as good as Dromaeosaurus.
I love it. You're like, I forget what it is. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's it doesn't matter.
One of my dear friends, he was a guest on the show early on, like 4 years ago when I first started, named Brian Switek. And I'm sure if you're on a feed reader that you read a lot of Brian Switek's work, because he is one of the kind of preeminent science writers in the paleo world.
Right.
Yeah. If you go back through all of these articles that you're probably always sent, but may or may not read.
I'm sure. Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff.
Oh, I read them. I'm like, this is great.
Isn't it surprising how much new shit there is all the time about such old creatures? Like every day we learn something new.
Yeah, and I think it's great. I thought this was special about dinosaurs, but doing Squirrel Girl for Marvel, I now get all the squirrel news too. And there is a surprising amount of squirrel news. I thought we had them sorted out.
I know, right? I had a guest on the show recently. His name was Ben, not was, his name still is. He's still with us, Ben Goldfarb. And he wrote a book all about beavers. And so we talked for an hour about beavers, which to me was like, wow, a whole hour dedicated to beavers. How are we going to do this? And then I was like, you wrote a whole fucking book about them.
Yeah, there's a lot to discuss about beavers.
Apparently there is. But you wrote a book about everything, which to me is like really intense. So how did you even know where to start? And how did you decide, you know, what to include and what to leave out? Because writing a book about everything, it's a normal sized book. Like it's a hefty book, but it's not overly big. So there's got to be shit here, or shit that never made it into here.
Yeah. Actually, calling it How to Admit Everything was done just at the very end. It was originally called like the Time Traveler's Handbook or something. And the title How to Admit Everything came to me. And I'm like, I love a title that promises the world. it's a very ambitious title, and it sets expectations so high that I really liked it. So to write the book, it was a lot of research and reading, obviously. And this is actually the first time I've written a nonfiction book, and it's very different from writing fiction. My experience with writing fiction is, you know, you sit down and you just start writing, and you stop when it's good. Pardon me. And then you've written a nonfiction, or you've written a fiction book rather. But with nonfiction, there's all this research that comes beforehand. Mm-hmm. And I was, you know, 8 months into this project and I hadn't written anything. I just read and taken notes. And I felt like, is this my life now? Like, when will I start writing? When will I know it's time to start writing? And the only way I could finally crack that was I went to a convention in Scotland. And then I stayed a week afterwards in this basement apartment I'd rented in a city where I knew no one and had nothing to do. And all I could do was write. And I wrote about 10,000 words in that week. And I realized, all right, this book might be possible. I wasn't even sure if it was possible because I was like, you know, like, how can you condense civilization into, you know, 400 some odd pages? is there, even if you could do that, is there enough there to make it worthwhile, or would it just be stupid stuff that everyone knows? Like, I wasn't sure the book was possible. It was such a relief, like a year into this project, realizing that it was possible, or at least part of it was possible, and I could actually write it.
I can only imagine. I mean, I can't really imagine. I just co-wrote my first book. It comes out in October.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you. And I mean, I did minimal work compared to the writer.
I made it my business to do minimal work on this project.
That's kind of my MO. No, so my other podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, the host of that, Steve Novella, was like, we're going to write a book. And we were like, okay. And so there's five of us on the podcast. And, you know, Steve really took the reins. But it's interesting that you talk about the title, too, because ours is called The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, which is also like quite an endeavor.
It's great. Like, I love a title that promises everything.
So. It promises everything. Yeah. And so your book teaches us how to rebuild civilization from scratch, really. Yep. Our book teaches you how to know, as the subtitle says, how to know what's really real in a world increasingly full of fake.
That's so important, too. Like, that's great.
So I love that there's kind of that meshing there, but I will tell you, like, he is a workhorse. I wrote maybe not even 10 of the chapters. And of course, we like work together to make sure it all came from a single voice and blah, 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 blah. But like, I can only imagine sitting down, locking myself in the basement, kind of like pushing. I'm the queen procrastinator, and I am in awe of writers who churn out books. Like, I just don't, and I don't want to say churn out, like that minimizes it. Like, obviously you worked on this for a long time and it's a lot of hard work, but like, I'm in awe of the capability to be able to conceive of something and then have it come to fruition all through like words. Just those are the words that were in your brain, and now they're in somebody else's brain.
That's the magic of writing. But I feel like it's sort of like what I was talking about with Dinosaur Comics, right? Where if I had sat down to do 15 years of these comics and say, that's impossible and insane, I'm not going to do it, I wouldn't even know where to start. And with this, with How to Bend Everything, it was, well, I don't know how to write a guide to reinventing civilization from scratch in any time period, but I do know how to explain how language works. So I'll do that. And then I can explain how, you know, a water pump works. So I'll do that. And break it into like tiny sections I could do over a couple days until you look back at it and you're like, well, this is becoming something. And you can smooth the parts out together, give it a uniform voice, and start writing the connective tissue you need to make it a complete text. But it's a lot of breaking it into tiny pieces. You can do a piece and say, yes, that part's done. It's perfect. Now for the rest of the 80,000 pieces that go along with this. But just tiny chunks is what makes it possible for me. Because I look at stuff I've done, I'm like, I don't know how I did that. That's impossible. I don't know what happened here. But at the time, I can do a tiny piece of it.
And it's smart because even though it does have a narrative thread, it really is one of these books where if you wanted to, you could read it in out of order. Like, you could go through and you could just find a section that you think is really interesting and read about that section and then go back and kind of continue. I love that it's really graphic. I love that there are so many different images and schematics. And I also love, I have to say, that you fully take advantage of the footnote. I'm a big fan of the footnote. Some people like the footnote. Some people don't like the footnote. Tell me about your take on the footnote.
So this book has both footnotes and endnotes. I go all in on the small text. That's a structural choice. The footnotes are in the voice of the book saying, you know, here's some extra stuff about this. The endnotes are outside the book where it's me saying, as Ryan North, the person speaking to you right now, here's some notes I have to make. Because the challenge of the book is this book is written from the future where they have time machines. So every open question should be answered. They should not have any mysteries about the past because they literally have time machines. But we do still have some mysteries that we don't know the answers to. So anywhere where I had to make a best guess or say like this might go, there's some discussion or debate about this one point, I put that in the end notes. I didn't want to make a science book that was spreading misinformation. That seems like a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But I also wanted the book to be a sincere effort to actually be useful. Like, if you did find yourself lost in time, this book would literally sincerely be useful for solving that problem. So it was sort of a balancing act. And the footnotes I love just structurally, because I feel like even a conversation, like we were talking right now, we had an aside about Andy Weir's movie based on his book. Mm-hmm. And that's a perfect footnote. It's something that if you're interested, you can follow it. And it's a cool, self-contained little thing. And I feel like humans, at least humans I talk to, tend to have conversations that way. And I love the footnote gives you, it's like a mini choose your own adventure, right? Because you can decide to read it now. Maybe you'll come back later. Maybe you'll go back to it at the end of the sentence. It gives the reader a choice to how they want to read this content. And I feel like anything we can do to make a book, I guess, interactive is what I'm looking for. And make a book.
Yeah, like multifaceted.
Yeah, the book has a conversation with you, or you're having a conversation with the book rather than just sitting back and absorbing it like you would a film. I think that's totally something that books can do that we should take advantage of.
And you use footnotes the right way. Like, I have to read a lot of academic texts recently because I've gone back to school to finish my PhD. And some of these...
Oh, wow. That's hard. Congratulations. I did a master's. I'm like, I'm done.
Thanks. Don't congratulate me yet. I'm only a second year. Yeah,
I did a master's too. For doing it. For attempting it.
I did my master's in neuroscience. My PhD is in clinical psych. And guess what? None of my courses from my master's count towards my PhD.
Oh, that's always fun.
So I'm reading a lot of academic texts, or a lot of psychology texts, which kind of blur the line between academic and sort of popular science. But I find that a lot of these writers will use footnotes just to reference other works, which is, I think, a better use of endnotes. It's super annoying.
Yep.
But then you read people like Mary Roach, you know, one of my kind of great loves when it comes to, science, kind of nonfiction narrative science. I think Mary Roach uses footnotes the correct way. And I think you use them very similar to that way. It's like a little aside or a little bit more information. And often it's funny. It's like really funny. And so you don't want to not read the footnotes because that's where some of the secret humor is.
Yeah, no, I'm big into secrets, just in everything I do. Dinosaur Comics, if you hold your mouse over the image, there's a secret punchline. In Squirrel Girl, there's secret text at the bottom of the page that has extra jokes. But I love the idea that we're asking people, as writers, you want them to buy a book. And you want them to give you their money. Mm-hmm. And like, comic books, regular books, none of them are really cheap. You're asking for funds from people. And I feel like when you're literally cramming jokes in the margins, you're showing you're doing all you can to make this a worthwhile purchase.
So true. I love that. And also in a lot of the graphics as well. Did you hire an illustrator for this book?
Yeah. My friend Lucy Bellwood did the pictures for it.
They're so
which was
good.
Great. I was like, I wrote this book and I thought, this is a pretty good book I've written. It's super great. I'm going to send it to Lucy and say, here's the parts I need pictures. And she'll have everything she needs from the text because it's such a brilliant book. And then she came back to me and she's like, I don't understand this. This doesn't make any sense. What are you saying here? And I was like, oh, right. The best way to learn something is try to teach it to someone else. So it was a great process just to get those pictures, but also to realize the parts in the text that needed to be cleaned up and needed to be more clear. And
And that the illustrations can sometimes help with that as well. You know, sometimes as much as you talk around something, it's not going to make sense unless you have schematics. And you know this because your training is in computer science.
Yep. Yep.
Where does that compute? Like, where is that connection between a computer? I mean, I love it. I am, you know, the first person, if you ask, is our STEM fields creative? Our STEM fields, you know, I don't, the whole left brain, right brain thing is bullshit. Definitely.
I'm right there with you.
Yeah. You know, like, obviously, it's a super creative endeavor. I love that you had this sort of transition. Maybe we don't even call it a transition, but this marrying of computer science and artistry, writing. But where did that first come to be? Because it does seem a bit like a career shift.
Yeah, it kind of, I guess. I remember when I was applying to undergrad, I was torn between computer science and English. And I remember my dad, he said two things. One was, if you study computer science, you can always, you know, write in your spare time. And I was like, yeah, maybe, I guess. And the other thing he said was, you're only going to English because a girl you like is going to English. And I was like, shut up, Dad.
You okay, I guess.
Not like that. I love the humanities, which I do. But then when I was in undergrad, I went to computer science and I was really proud because I managed to get a minor in film studies while I was doing computer science. I love that I had like humanities and computer science together in that one degree. And then when I did my master's, it was in computational linguistics, which is a field of AI concerned with getting computers to speak and generate natural language. So like Siri is an example of that. She didn't exist when I was doing it, but that's that sort of thing. And the funny thing, we're talking about education, the funny thing about that was when this book was finished, my publisher was like, all right, we need a bio for you. And so I sent over the standard bio I use for comics, which is like, Ryan's done this comic, he's done that comic, he's won this comics award, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, this is good. Do you have anything that, you know, gives you science credentials? And I was like, I don't think so. Oh, wait, no, I have a master's of science. Let's do that. I forgot that I had this degree. But I don't like have it on my wall or talk about it to people. I forgot to put it in my bio. So it was, I said that and I realized this is the most suspicious sounding email I've ever sent. That says, oh no, I have a Master of Science. I just forgot about it. Put that in my bio.
Oh yeah.
That's so funny. I dug up my degree and took a picture of it to send it to her.
Well, it's like that implicit knowledge, right? Like, we forget about that kind of stuff. Like, there's the explicit and the implicit. And, like, there's stuff we learn in school that they can never take away from us. Like, that knowledge is that knowledge. And, like, the way that you learn to think, obviously, with a computer science degree, you learn to think in a very deep and creative way that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to do. But if you're not actively, you know, coding, you might forget that you have all that knowledge.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have, this is probably a poorly thought out theory, but I have this theory and I feel the theory is that I feel like everyone should have at least, like, there should be one mandatory computer programming course because one, it demystifies what's going on, and two, it gives you the confidence and the ability to solve problems if you have them. Like, I have friends who, you know, they get a spreadsheet of data and they're like, oh, I wish I could grab this data in this way, but the spreadsheet software's not letting me do it. And it would be the easiest thing in the world to, you know, just dump that in a database and do it that way, or write a quick script to generate the data you need. And since they don't have those skills and don't know how easy those skills are to acquire, they're left either not doing it or like paying a consultant hundreds of dollars to write something for them. And it's sort of like, you know, somehow growing up without knowing how to operate a knife, and you're always paying people to cut your food.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm one of those people, like, and I have a, you know, advanced education from expensive universities, but
they're all expensive.
Oh, I know. But like, I'm working on my website right now, trying to move my web store over. And I mean, long story short, nobody cares about these details, but I'm wanting to use one of these print on demand companies so that I can have like a white label, you know, you can buy a t-shirt in multiple colors instead of me having to stock all of them in my closet. And, you know, it seems like a better idea, but for some reason, the shipping from the print on demand and the shipping from Squarespace don't play nice together. So I literally have to write an algorithm and I don't know how, and I'm stuck. Like, I'm calling on my friends who have advanced degrees in math because I'm like, I don't know enough algebra to be able to program my web store. It happens though. Like, these are real, you know, they always say like, you're never going to use this in life.
Yeah.
Yes, you are.
This is exactly it. And I always think about my grade 10 math teacher, Mr. Bravo, was great. And he would always say, when we said, when are you going to use this? He'd say, well, you're never going to, there'll be a day when you don't have a calculator in your pocket. And he was wrong about that. So now we all have calculators in our pocket. But he also said, and he may be true right about this. He's like, one day you're going to get on a bus and you're going to be short of fare. You won't have the money for the bus. And the bus driver will say, well, I'll let you on if you can tell me the derivative of this equation. And he would say this completely straight face. Like, I believe still that he believed it, and that made me believe it.
You know what? When you said grade 10, it instantly clicked in my head that you are Canadian.
Canadian. What do you guys call it?
10th grade.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Yeah.
I guess nobody's nerfed.
Exactly. No, that is the dividing line between the Great North.
Huh.
Yeah. Grade 10, 10th grade. And I only know that because I used to watch Degrassi.
Degrassi. Filmed in Toronto. That's where I'm from.
Nice. And so are you still living in Canada? Or are you once a Canadian, always a Canadian?
I mean, hopefully other countries let us in if we wanted to, but yeah.
Where do you live now?
I was born in Ottawa and I lived in Toronto since 2003.
Oh, nice. It's very cold there.
And not compared to Ottawa, it's not.
Oh, I see. I've only really spent time.
Toronto's on the lake.
Yes. It reminds me a lot, you know, like, I'm from Texas. I live now in Los Angeles. I lived in New York City for about a year. Toronto reminds me a lot of New York. I live in LA. So obviously compared to LA, Toronto's very cold. I've spent quite a bit of time in Vancouver and love it. And I spent a little bit of time in, what's it called? Where the Perimeter Institute is. In
Kingston?
No, Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics is in, I will find this out and I will tell you, these are things, Waterloo in Ontario.
Waterloo, yes, of course, Waterloo, yeah.
Waterloo. And I think it's cold there, too. I think it's just cold everywhere up there.
Well, I never thought I'd miss it. I moved to Toronto, and it's warmer there. But in Ottawa, when it's like, this won't mean anything because it's in Celsius, when it's minus 40 degrees, you'd walk outside in the morning, and you'd breathe in through your nose, and it'd be so cold that all the mucus in your nose would freeze, and you could crunch your nose, the hairs in it would crunch. And
what?
It wakes you up. I miss it. Like, you would be instantly awake because your nose would be...
Yeah, because you're so close to death. Like, how is that even possible? That doesn't sound, like, life-affirming.
It's, you know, like, this is gross, but, like, sometimes it's satisfying to pop a zit. It was satisfying to crunch your nose and crunch those nose hairs.
That does sound like fun, but then I feel like I would immediately die. That's the problem. That's too cold.
It takes, like, 5 minutes to die from cold. You don't...
You got time
to think about it.
Oh my gosh, Ryan, I've been having so much fun chatting with you. We've almost been talking for an entire hour. I don't want to keep you for too much longer, but I'm wondering if there's anything about the book that you want to make sure that we talk about before we move on to my kind of like closing spiel.
Oh gosh.
Favorite things you learned, favorite chapters, anything in it that you're like, oh, I'd be remiss if we didn't bring this up.
Gosh, I guess favorite chapter. There's a chapter, because it's not just technology in the book. There's also philosophy, art, and music. Here's how you invent instruments. Here's how you invent visual perspective, stuff like that. One of the favorite chapters that surprised me about how fun it was to write was this chapter on religion and philosophy. Because I was like, oh, I'm getting into some, you know, dangerous territory here. But it's not so much like, here's which religion is correct, and more like, here are different philosophies of being and philosophies of mind that people have explored, and you can choose whatever you want for your civilization. But I describe them all in terms of high fives, like God or gods giving out high fives. And it was such a nice way to like sidestep all the stuff that comes with that territory that you kind of made me wish. I tried to find ways in the book that I could also describe other concepts in terms of high fives. I didn't find any, but all of this to say, it's not just technologies, but also other things you need for civilization, like farming and art and music and culture and things like that.
Which is so important, I think, you know, considering the era we're living in, especially here in the US, with the administration that we are somehow surviving underneath.
Sorry about your country.
Thank you. I promise I had nothing to do with it. I promise. But yeah, I mean, there's so many things that I think are important sometimes to remember, especially when you are constantly being bombarded with rhetoric that kind of belittles or demeans intellect and education. Mm-hmm. Remember that all of these things really did exist because of creativity and hard work and kind of mental stamina. Like, these individuals throughout history thought about these things and worked really hard collectively and collaboratively to solve problems. And it's really kind of antithetical to progress to say that that's like an elite perspective or that that's only for certain people. Because the truth of the matter is, early on, there weren't that many people, and all the people really contributed, didn't they?
Well, that's one of the, I think, the most terrifying things in the book that I hit on is we take a lot of things for granted. Among the things we take for granted is the technologies we already have, including language. And we think of language as being like something we get for free, but it's not, especially written language. Like, there are civilizations that have lost the technology of writing. And like, that's to me, that's such a terrifying idea to have words like shapes on paper that meant something suddenly being without meaning. Mm-hmm. And like, it's, if you don't work on these things, if you don't share these things, if we don't learn these things, we can lose them. And there's no guarantee. I mean, I'm going to say this, it's the most pessimistic thing I've ever said. There's no guarantee that the future is going to be better.
Yeah.
If we don't work on it, it won't be. Like, it's important that we all work together to build the future we want, and you don't get it for free.
Absolutely. And I think that this is actually a really good seg to the way that I end every episode on the show, because I ask my guests the same two questions, and they're sort of like big picture questions, you know, and I see some themes come out through answers. Sometimes I'm surprised. I'll get an answer out of left field, like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. And sometimes I'll see, you know, similar responses. But I want your take, especially after writing a book like this, which is such a big picture book. And those questions are, when you think about the future in whatever kind of context is relevant to you right now, whether it be your own personal, you know, life or something a little bit bigger, the future of humanity, the future of the globe, the cosmos, even as it were. Number one, what is the thing that you are actually pessimistic about? You legitimately worry about, it keeps you up at night, you know, you, it's hard for you to see a silver lining. But on the flip side of that, what is the thing that you genuinely, and you're not just saying this to, you know, to be nice, you genuinely are optimistic about and you actually truly feel is looking up, is looking good in the future?
Okay, those are good. So the first one, I spent... This is the pessimistic one that makes me feel bad. Mm-hmm. I remember as a kid learning that one day the sun would become a red giant and engulf the earth. And I was like, wow, that's a ticking clock. It's millions of years, but we got this ticking clock and I was really pessimistic about it. And then it was only like within the past 5 years that I learned that the earth would probably no longer support life long before that, because the sun's changing all the time. And it's not just at the point where it engulfs the earth that is no longer hospitable to life. And that shaved off millions of years on this deadline. And it'll never affect me. I'll be long dead. But I was like legitimately depressed that the time I thought the earth was going to be destroyed or life on earth would be destroyed had been moved up when I wasn't looking somehow. And I was like, what? This is just the worst. I can't believe this. This is an outrage. But the thing I'm optimistic for, it's positive because of, not because I can't think of anything, because there's so many great things to think about, of course.
Sure.
Yep. I do think the thing I'm most optimistic for, and I'm trying to think of a way to say this that doesn't sound cheesy, but I feel like, I'll tell this by a story. Maybe a couple years ago, one of my friends, she was complaining that she has people she likes because they have good answers to questions and people she dislikes because they have rote answers to questions. Mm. And I was like, oh, interesting. And she's like, no, I'm going to ask you a question. And I was like, oh, shoot, I'm really on the spot here. Yeah. And she was like, what do you think about death? And I was like, well, honestly, I will tell you that I think it is a good thing because I remember reading about this artifact they found somewhere of this culture. And all it was a horse. They knew this culture had horses. It was they called it the horse riding culture, something along those lines. And that's all they know about these people that lived and died for thousands of years was that they liked horses. And it's such a small and pointless thing to know. But it made me realize, like, these people, they would have had people they loved, people they hated. Maybe they had, like, entire civilizations that they hated and villainized and were racist against. And those people are all gone. And when they died, their racism died with them. And, like, we look at our grandparents with their folksy racism about, like, my grandmother really hated the Acadians for no reason. And if she lived forever, she would be carrying that with her for a very long time, if not indefinitely.
Oh my gosh, this is so like, not where I thought you were going to go with this, but I love it so much.
So this is the thing, like, by people dying, we clear out old opinions that get stuck in our heads. And looking at the way the gay marriage thing has happened in both our countries, I feel like a lot of that has happened because people who grew up hating the gays are dying, and people growing up now, they know how it's not a big deal and doesn't really affect them. It's fine. Like, love who you love is no big deal. But I feel like if people from 300 years ago hadn't died, we wouldn't have gay marriage today because they'd still be where they were 300 years ago. I don't think people's ideas socially evolve as fast as their ideas of other things. All of this to say, the fact that humans are not mortal gives me tons of hope for the future, because it means the new generation, you know, kids today, they can do stuff and believe stuff and create stuff that we may be constitutionally incapable of doing on our own. Okay. And that is such a fast way to progress.
I love this, right? Like, the concept is that these kinds of things require generational change. They require the type of change that comes from birth and death, which, like, I never really thought about. And I have to say, it's so interesting that you brought this up, because when you were like, okay, so I had this friend who asked me what I think about death, I was like, yes. The funny thing is, my PhD, like, my area of research is death and dying psychotherapy. It's like something I think about.
What?
I know, it's like super weird.
Oh, wow.
That you brought that up. And so I was like, where's he? I can't wait to see where he's going with this. And of course, my argument is that American society has a very kind of unhealthy, psychologically unhealthy relationship with death, that we're a very death denying culture, and that there's a lot we can learn from other from multicultural viewpoints about having a healthier relationship with death, that maybe if we don't deny its existence, we won't fear it as much. And maybe if we don't fear it so much, we can actually factor it into the way that we live our lives, and we can live with more purpose and with more meaning because we know death is coming, right? Instead of just pretending that it's never going to happen. And so I've never, ever stopped to think about death as a almost evolutionary or a kind of societal construct, as something that is required for, you know, these so-called like meme shifts, these so-called, these big societal ideas, kind of the, what's his name? Whitehead scientific revolutions. Like, it's just not going to happen unless people who can't let go die.
Yeah. And it's very hard to let go. And it's sort of, when you were talking about that, it made me think of this theory of language I saw when I was doing my master's, where the paper I read was arguing that we have a couple of things we know about language, and one is it evolves very quickly, and we're not really sure why it changes so quickly. And the theory being put forward was, we know language is hard to learn, and we know it's anyone who's tried to learn a second language knows it's really hard to learn, right? Like it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And the paper was arguing, maybe language isn't just hard to learn, maybe language is impossible to learn. And so we never actually learn the language our parents teach us. We learn an approximation of it that allows communication, but all the fuzzy edges around it are going to be different. And so since we're all building our own little idiolects when we learn a language, we're learning an approximation of English or whatever. That means, of course, it's going to evolve quickly because you're not doing a perfect copy. You're getting a very messy copy every time you have a new generation coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the same idea of like the fact that you have people who have a thing, are dying, and the new people have a different thing. That is, I mean, that's evolution right there, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's like a quote unquote kind of social evolution. And sometimes it can be for the worse, like in that movie Multiplicity, a copy of a copy. But oftentimes, as you know, the great Martin Luther King said, I think I'm paraphrasing, or maybe I'm saying it exactly, I don't remember, but the, what did he say? He said that the arc of time is long, but it bends towards progress.
Bends towards,
Yes. And that, you know, we forget that sometimes. Sometimes we find ourselves in these like very regressive periods where there are people where it's like impossible for us to wrap our heads around how this is happening. But then we forget that part of the reason it feels like such a slap in the face is because we've come so far.
Yeah, you know what? I think that quote is my optimistic thing, because I feel like that is something that is something you believe, and there might not be proof. I feel like there's proof over the past couple hundred years of our own civilizations, but like that horse loving civilization, they're all gone. Any progress they had is gone. And I feel like the optimistic thing that I believe that gives me hope is that I feel like we are at a point, hopefully, where there can still be, then there will still be continued progress as the arc gets to keep going and keep bending towards justice and progress.
Yes, justice is actually what he said, which in my mind is a synonym for progress. Some people don't think so, but yes, I think social justice and progress go hand in hand. Oh my gosh, Ryan, this was so much fun. Thank you so much for joining me. And
I had a great time.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Filling us in on your insights and all of the brilliant work that you've done. Everybody, the book is How to Invent Everything, A Survival Guide for the Stranded Time Traveler. And it's available now, right?
Yes.
Awesome.
Because this will be in the future when it's out.
Yes, it will be. Well, again, thank you so much. I had a great time. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.